Welcome everyone to the podcast for the IBM Press WebSphere Data Power SLA Appliance Handbook. My name is Bill Hines. I'm with Software Services for WebSphere, or Lab Services. And with me, I have my co-authors John Rasmussen, Jamie Ryan, Simon Capadia, and Jim Brennan. So what we're going to do is break this podcast into three different episodes, and we'll cover some of the questions that we've been asked since the book's been published, just as a basic groundwork for the book and what it covers and why we wrote it and all those sorts of good things. So we're going to proceed with episode one. And I think what we should do is probably start right off at the top here and ask John, what is an appliance, especially from an IT perspective? What does the term appliance mean?
Okay, Bill, thanks for that introduction. Before we talk about the data power appliance, I think it might be beneficial to talk about the environment that exists without the data power device. When one begins the process of providing security for a B2B application or providing security for a web service application or providing message enrichment during message traffic or implementing the functionality of an enterprise service bus, there is quite a list of assets that one must gather. Of course, one has to have a hardware device to run the application on. An operating system will have to be implemented, and of course, this can't be just any operating system. If this application is going to reside in a demilitarized zone, in a DMZ, it'll have to be a hardened operating system that limits vulnerability to threats or hacks. We'll have to have a development environment, and within that development environment, a litany of APIs will be utilized. We'll utilize APIs for XML processing, parsing, transformation, for implementing security, for example, the fetching and processing of X509 certificates. Of course, WS security will be utilized if we're using web services. The requirements of performing things like XML digital signature are so CPU intensive, or things such as schema validation, that they are underutilized or not implemented at all in these types of applications. Single sign-on processes such as SAML, Spinego, and Kerberos will be utilized, as will a variety of logging functionality. If we're using enterprise service bus capabilities, we'll be providing mediation across a wide variety of protocols such as HTTP and HTTPS, NFS, FTP, and so forth. The point is, this type of functionality is implemented in a very costly manner. It's not only costly in terms of the programming required, but it's costly in terms of the licensing that's required to support these this functionality. The licensing of operating systems, of hardware, the support of those of the operating system and hardware, and so forth. The Data Power Appliance provides all of these capabilities in a single solution. We provide, within the Data Power environment, the ability to perform a wide variety of security or ESB functionality, in addition to ancillary programming functionality such as binary message transformation. All of this functionality is provided in a single firmware product that is provided in a signed and encrypted fashion. They are no single APRs or code updates that are implemented within Data Power. Everything is provided within this highly optimized and hardened firmware. At its core, the Data Power device is a highly optimized XML and XSLT processing and transformation environment. The physical attributes of the Data Power Appliance include dedicated hardware. For example, there is a dedicated hardware device for processing of SSL, HTTPS protocols. There is a hardware device for the processing of cryptographic operations such as RSA operations and asymmetric encryption. You may know that the processing requirements for asymmetric encryption are heavily CPU intensive. The use of dedicated hardware for this processing provides a highly efficient implementation within the Data Power device. Data Power also uses dedicated XML processing hardware. For example, the XG4 processor provides hardware-based XML parsing and schema validation. The hardware security model module is a optional feature that provides FIPS 140-2 level 3 support in a highly secured cryptographic key store. The Data Power device utilizes redundant features such as hot swappable power supplies, hot swappable fans, and it itself is a tamper-proof environment. If someone were to try to physically access the internals of the Data Power device, it would render itself inoperable, subsequent to sending alerts to monitoring agents. In addition, the Data Power device has passed stringent compliance testing, such as common criteria. Now, this all-in-one solution that I've mentioned, if we just considered those as capabilities of the Data Power implementation, I think that would speak highly and well for the Data Power capabilities. But that would not give justice to the work of people like Eugene Kuznetsov, Jan Nelson, and Nico Matsakis, other members of the core Data Power team that Eugene united at MIT back in the beginning of the Data Power days. Eugene and his team were working on advanced programming concepts such as reconfigurable computing and dynamic code generation. In addition to data-oriented programming, XML is a good example of data-oriented programming. And the Data Power device, again, is a highly optimized, self-optimizing XML processing machine. The Data Power device is not so much programmed as it is configured. Fine-tuning of configurations are implemented by the use of XSLT. All right, Bill, well, thank you very much. I think that's a brief introduction to the Data Power device, its physical attributes and processing capabilities in a B2B web services ESB environment. Thank you.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you for that answer. Let's move along a little further and talk about specifically what Data Power SOA appliances are, since those are the subject matter of our book. Jamie, how about you tackle that one for us?
Sure, no problem, Bill. So Data Power SOA appliances were created by Data Power Incorporated back in 1998 to address challenges that they saw around XML. So the founders of the company, Eugene Kuznetsov, who wrote one of the forewords for our book, and some of his other MIT alumni, started in Cambridge with XML parsers and transformation engines. They saw that as XML was going to become more popular, people were going to have problems with its verbosity in terms of parsing and transforming those messages. Because they're verbose and because they're human readable, though that can be debated, they take up a lot of processing memory, a lot of CPU cycles to build these structures in memory and process them. So they started with a patented parsing engine and transformation engine. And then they very quickly learned that the appliance model was the way to go. By using the appliance model, they could rely on hardware acceleration of both basic things like SSL, but also in hardware acceleration of those XML processes. So at its core, a Data Power SOA appliance is an XML parsing and processing engine that relies on specific hardware and custom firmware on top of that hardware to really process XML and its related specifications very quickly. When IBM saw that the appliance market, especially in the SOA realm, was going to be big, they looked for the best of breed in the industry and they found Data Power. So by that time, Data Power had already introduced three different models, one around acceleration, one around security, and one around integration. And they purchased Data Power back in October of 2005. Since then, there have been two new devices introduced, and I'd like to talk a bit about each of those current products. So there are currently five products in the Data Power product line. The XA35, so in each of these cases, the number is going to increase, and the letter after X is kind of talking about what the device is specifically geared toward. So in the XA35, it's all about XML acceleration. And this device is used strictly for transforming XML into other XML formats, into HTML, into WML, and similar languages, XHTML, etc. This is used for content providers, for major websites that have lots of data in XML and need to present it in HTML or WML, especially in various different styles. So if they have the same data that they want to present on a mobile phone differently than they want to in a browser, they can do that quick transformation to XML or to HTML and WML at the same time. The XS40, that's XML security, takes everything on the XA35, takes that hardware accelerated performance for parsing and transforming messages and adds a security layer. So there's several different kinds of security, most geared around web services and web applications, especially around the web services security standards. So WS security encryption and decryption, digital signatures and signature verification, and access control. Access control is really a big part of what the XS40 does, and it can interface with existing identity stores, authentication servers, authorization servers, and really becomes the enforcement point for all your access control policies. XML threat protection is also another big feature on the XS40. With the introduction of XML and web services, people are now sending application data over standard port 80, port 443, and that's going through the firewall and being executed on internal application servers. There's some danger inherent in that, and Data Power looks out for some of the up-and-coming XML threats to protect your back-end application servers from those threats in the DMZ. The next device, the XI50, stands for XML integration, and so that adds functionality like protocol mediation between HTTP and MQ, or WebSphere JMS, or TIBCO EMS, FTP. So there are several common protocols that really address a good 90-95% of the needs as far as connecting external web services and XML requests to internal services on other protocols, on other OSs, mainframes, etc. Besides protocol mediation, we can also do message transformation, not just the XML to XML and XML to HTML that we did with the XA35 and XS40, but also any to any. So binary formats, COBOL copybook, text formats, EBCDIC, EDI, all of these formats can be transformed to and from XML. So it's a really easy way to modernize your back-end mainframe applications. There's lots of data, there's lots of power in those applications, and instead of rewriting everything in a distributed system to expose those web services, we can simply do the transformation very quickly on Data Power as a gateway. So we can take a web service request, we can strip off the headers, we can transform the XML into a COBOL copybook format and deliver it to the back-end mainframe. The XI50 also introduces database access, so you can write data to or read data from a database during the transaction. So this is a great way to enrich messages coming in and going out. So really, the XI50 takes all of the features of the XA35 and the XS40 and adds in those integration features. The two most recent products are a little more specific. So these are geared toward different industry verticals. The first one is the XB60, which is a B2B appliance. And this focuses on some of the B2B protocols, like AS2 and AS3. It also features a transaction viewer for going back through transactions and correlating the incoming request with the outgoing MDN acknowledgments. It also has a partner profiles, so you can set up all your trading partners and recognize which protocols they'll be speaking, which protocols you want to translate to for outgoing messages, and then all of that is done, again, at rapid speed and in the security gateway, in the DMZ, rather than having all that data come internal to the application layer before you decompress and decode those AS2 and AS3 protocols. The other kind of industry-specific device is the XM70. So the XM70 focuses on low-latency messaging. While probably the most common or the most well-known place that this is used is trading floors, so financial systems where they need to distribute large amounts or small amounts of data to a large number of consumers in kind of a fan out methodology. So stock quotes, trades, things that really require microsecond latencies and vast one-to-many or many-to-many publication. Other industries where this is useful are energy industries where they have lots of smart meter data that has to get back to collected by the utility provider themselves. Also, the prices of different of energy as that fluctuates during the day. So there are several different industries where this is useful, but it's more of a specific use case than the generic XI50, which focuses on all integration mechanisms. The five devices are physically separated really only by color. They go from green to yellow to blue to purple to silver. But they're all 1U data center network resident devices. They look like pizza boxes. And they are security hardened, default locked down. So they've been penetration tested by the Department of Defense. They're certified for all the appropriate security certifications for data center resident devices. And from an operations perspective, they behave similarly to any other piece of hardware. They can be monitored via SNMP. They can send traps. They can integrate with your logging systems, et cetera. So really, the benefit that these appliances provide is a configuration web GUI-driven way to do things that are much more complex if you would otherwise be doing them in software. Just as the founders recognized that hardware could make a big difference for processing XML, they also recognized that having a useful web interface for configuring very complex things like WS security, encryption, or digital signature verification could really provide quicker time to market and higher ease of use. And that's about it for that's what a Data Power SOA appliance is.
All right. Thank you, Jamie, for that comprehensive answer. I think you covered all the bases there. So excellent response. Jamie is in tech sales, and he's based out on the West Coast, out of beautiful San Diego, California. And so if any of your customers out there are interested in looking into Data Power, and you bring the sales team out, Jamie may well be the guy that comes out to demonstrate the device to you. And I kind of get upset with him because every time I get a chance to go to Hawaii or somewhere cool like that, Jamie grabs it up because he's 3,000 miles closer than I am, essentially. So, but that's good for him. Okay, and also Jamie on our book project was known as the professor because of his fantastic English skills. So he kept us all on our toes as far as, you know, even though we all had writing experience, making sure that all the little things like putting the periods inside of the ending quotation marks and things like that were done. So it really helped us to make sure that by the time the book got to our publisher, they really didn't have a lot of work to do, and they were quite impressed with the quality of the material we turned into them. Okay, so let's move on. Data Power appliances are pretty much used in three different areas primarily, and Jamie touched on these. The first one being for acceleration of XML and non-XML transformations. They are IBM's hardware ESB, so they are very completely functional as an enterprise service bus. And the third area, probably the most well-known, is the security aspect. They're known as security devices, even though they do so much more. But I think it's such an important area that I want to have our resident security and networking expert, Simon, touch on the security aspects of the device.
Thanks, Bill. I remember the first time I saw one of these Data Power appliances, and it was a blue box about like the size of a box that pizza comes in, maybe a little bigger, and it sort of sits on a table. And you plug it in and you turn it on and you think, yeah, okay, I've turned it on, it's just like any other computer, it makes a loud noise, lots of fans come on, and then nothing happens. And it's always struck me that that's really how secure computer systems should be designed. I mean, when I say nothing happens, you get the loud noise, you get a couple of lights turn on, and you know, literally you can't do anything on the computer itself. That's about as secure as it can get. You plug in a network cable to the device, and you know, a little light comes on because it registers that there's a physical connection. But again, you can't actually connect to the device over the network in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the first thing you have to do is plug in a serial cable, which usually means that you have to be physically near the device. And you have to log into the device using a predefined username and password. And you have to accept the end user license agreement. It forces you to specify your own password for access to the device's management interface, and then you're finally onto the device itself. And then you have to start off by, for instance, bringing up network interfaces. And it's only once you bring up that network interface that the device will actually start communicating on the network with other computers that are on that network. But even then, there's still no services running on the device. It's not like a general purpose, like a Unix machine. If you look at a Unix or a Windows machine, it's got lots and lots of services listening on different ports to make, you know, life easier for communications and so on. On Data Power, you have no services running by default, so you can start up you can run a couple of commands over that serial port and start up the web-based management interface, which is what most people do in the first place to start configuring the device. So you can start up a secure shell instance, but I guess what I'm saying is that Data Power was designed from the ground up with security in mind. It was designed from the ground up to be a secure appliance. And one of the fundamental basics there is that it needs to be secure by default, secure out of the box. Now, when I say designed for security, I don't just mean from the network connectivity level. I mean, the device itself is physically secure, and it's tamper-proof. I believe that if you turn the screw something more than, I don't know, 90 degrees, then it's going to set off a tamper alarm, and that renders the device ineffective. So basically, if someone tries to physically access the device, it'll turn itself off and refuse to do anything useful again until you send it back to IBM in exchange for a different device. It is rack-mounted in terms of being used to connect to other computers on a network level. Let's go beyond that a little bit. So inside the device itself is a number of pieces of hardware which are dedicated to security. So there's the obvious ones which are fundamentally security related, things like the cryptographic hardware. There's a cryptographic accelerator on the card. It's possible to purchase a device with a FIPS 140 to level 2 and level 3 compliant hardware security module, and that cryptographic accelerator with HSM potentially is where a lot of the asymmetric encryption takes place. One of the things that DataPower does extremely well is process XML. It processes XML at extremely high speeds. Now, in this day and age of web services and web services security specifically as a standard, in order to be able to successfully and efficiently process web services security, you need to fundamentally be able to process XML. A lot of the cost of processing and dealing with the common standards such as XML encryption, XML decryption, digital signature, dealing with standards for access control for, with assertions such as standards such as SAML. All of these things require the processing of XML. I mentioned XML threat protection as one of the capabilities that's provided on the device. It's something that's relatively unique to DataPower. Not only is it capable of processing at high speed, but the parser that deals with the XML inside the appliance is capable of setting limits on how it processes the incoming XML and how it builds node sets in memory. That capability actually allows it to deal with some of the more complex XML threats that are out there on the market. In fact, there's a whole host of XML threats that simply putting DataPower in front of your existing web services protects you from almost automatically out of the box by clicking a couple of buttons.
All right, Simon, thank you very much. Simon actually was the only member of the book team that wasn't based in the U.S. He's out of the U.K., and that made life pretty interesting for all of us, especially Simon, because, of course, all of our conference calls and things were based around U.S. time, and Simon had to put in a lot of interesting hours. We all did pretty much for the book. We had to write this on our own time. That's just the way it is with book writing and legalities and so forth, since we were being paid directly by the publisher. So it was pretty much a year's worth of nights and weekends for all of us, and made it particularly tough on Simon, though, because of the time differences. And of course, we worked together really well through the whole process. At times, I think I aggravated all these guys equally with my taskmaster-like drill sergeant schedule that I had everybody on, but especially Simon, since it was so rough on him being in a whole different time zone and so forth, and it looked pretty much like he was never going to get paid for doing the book anyway due to tax laws and so forth. So I really commend his patience throughout the whole process. And, you know, at times I had him upset with me, so I told my wife that if any packages came in from England that she should feel free to open them before I got home from work. So, okay, just a little insight into the fun of writing a book. Let's move on here and talk about these particular devices. And you know, so you purchase one, everybody's excited, the box arrives at the door, you go down and grab it from the shipping dock. And Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about what comes next as far as the initial configuration and setup of these things and what they look like coming out of the shipping container?
Sure, thanks, Bill. What I'd encourage you to do before really getting too excited is curb your excitement a little bit and take a step back, because one of the most important things about setting this up is proper planning. And when I say proper planning, really get all the stakeholders involved that should be involved. And that's not just your network team. That could be and should be your security team should be involved. Your middleware team should be involved. Your application team should be involved. So proper planning, if done right, should make this process very simple. So when you know where this thing's going to sit in your network, you know you have 4 Ethernet ports, so you have to plan where they're going to be within your network. And when you open it up, you'll realize there really isn't much to it. It's just, you heard the expression, it's about the size of a pizza box, but a bit bigger than that. There's really not much to look at. You really have 2 power supplies. You have 4 Ethernet ports and 1 serial port. So right there, you can tell right there, there's not much you really need to do to get this thing at least cabled and racked. So your first step is to rack and cable the device. It is a 1-unit rack-mountable device. And as we had mentioned before, that The only way to bring this device up after it's been racked and cabled is to be physically at the device, because to bring it up, there's no connections from any of the interfaces available that you can use except for the serial port that's provided. So you have to be physically at the device. There is a no modem serial cable provided that you'll be using to connect to the device. And most likely you'll need a USB to serial converter if your laptop or whatever you're connecting does not have a serial port to connect with. So it's important to plan to know if you're going to need that so you're not disappointed when you get in there and you can't even bring up the device. So once you're able to connect to the serial port, you're going to need some type of terminal emulator. Windows has the Hyper Terminal that seems to be working very well with it. So you connect up and you're connected through the serial port. You have your Hyper Terminal or terminal emulator up, and then it's just a power switch on the back. Then you boot up the device. You turn on the power. Be patient. It takes some time the first time the device comes up, and you'll start seeing that the device is coming up on your emulator screen. And you'll see it starting to come up in the whole booting process. Then you'll go through a series of license agreements, and you'll have to log in using the admin password provided. That's going to be in your manual, so be sure to read the manual before doing any of this. And once you provide the admin password, you're going to have to reset that password. That's a requirement right off the bat. And one of the most important things I can tell you here is remember that admin password. That's extremely important. If the admin password is lost or forgotten and not able to be retrieved, the device has to physically go back to the manufacturer to be reset. So again, just write down that password, keep it in a safe, secure place, and don't lose it. So now you're logged into the device. You reset your admin password. There is actually a wizard type approach that can be taken. You can follow the wizard, and that will ask you a series of questions. Basically, what you want to do is bring up one of the interfaces, or you can bring up all. But typically, you can just bring up one of the interfaces, which will be used for management. Again, that can be done via the wizard that's provided, or you can use the CLI commands to do this. So when I say bring up the management interface, the first thing you'll do is you'll assign an IP address. That would have been given to you, and here's that proper planning. This would have been given to you by your network team. You assign your IP address to that interface, and possibly or more likely a default gateway to the interface. And after that, now the interface has an IP address and can be accessed. But you still have to manage the device. There are several ways, and we mentioned the serial connection, and then there is also, you can do it through SSH or a web GUI, and that can be done over this interface that you have configured. But to do this, you have to enable it. This is all disabled by default, so you would then proceed to most likely enable your web GUI, and again, that can be done via CLI or the wizard. If you took the wizard approach, it would ask you if you'd like to do this. So you enable the web GUI and assign that web GUI the IP address of the interface that you had already configured. Technically, that's all you need to do at this point. Now you should have access to the device via the web GUI if everything was done properly and you can see it on the network. And then once that's up, you can connect through the web GUI or you can remain on CLI to configure the remainder of the interfaces in a similar fashion, assign their IP and such. And then you can bring up your SSH and assign that to the web to your management interface that you brought up. So now you have your device. You can connect through SSH. You can connect through CLI, through SSH. There is an XML management interface, which is just a SOAP request you can send to the device to configure the device at that point. And again, that has to be enabled. It's disabled by default, so you can go in through the web GUI and enable that. So now you have your device up. All your interfaces configured, all of your management configured, web GUI, SSH. You maybe want to enable your XML management interface. And now you can proceed to do what the device really is designed to do, and that's proxy your backend, maybe web services, maybe web applications, maybe things like protocol bridging, and that's done via services. So you'll have to get onto the device and proceed to configure your services to do these types of things. So in a nutshell, that's pretty much it. That's how the device is installed and brought up into a working state where you can start to create these services to do what the device is meant to do, which would be proxy traffic to your back end or any other need you might have for it.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Jim is actually my cousin. Most people don't know that, even the people that we work with. And he's also one of our field consultants out of New Jersey, spends a lot of time out there with customers. And yeah, I had worked on an earlier book related to WebSphere application server deployment and advanced configuration. And after that long and arduous process, I swore I'd never write another book again. But Jim was really hot on this Data Power book idea, and he kept bugging me about it. And then finally, at one of our family functions, he plied me with enough Miller Lite to get me to agree to do it. And at that point, once I was locked in pretty much by my word, my next job was to assemble the best people I could find to put this book together. And really, there was a need because the Data Power team has traditionally been really paranoid about releasing any information about the device. Prior to the acquisition by IBM, it was really difficult even just to get the product documentation. And that's because they take security very seriously, and also because they wanted to protect their stature as a leader in this young, fledgling area of appliances. A lot of big competitors were hot on their heels trying to find out how the thing ticks and how it works. So, and when IBM acquired them, some of our customers were used to all the information IBM puts out there, looking for info centers and so forth, which really didn't exist. So we saw the need for the book. We wanted to complement the documentation with things that were more, I guess, use case based, how to, rather than here's how this works, but when do you want to do it? Why do you want to do it? How do you do it? Some of the workarounds and things. So, and that's pretty much the background of why we wrote the book. And again, I mentioned that John is somebody that came in with the Data Power team. He was with Data Power prior to the IBM acquisition, so he had the most experience. Jamie, super sharp guy that right from the beginning was on this thing and seemed to be able to absorb everything about it. Simon, as the security lead over in Europe, certainly very security knowledgeable and also one of the early people to get involved with Data Power. And I also wanted him for his networking skills, which came in quite handy as, you know, the networking area is just something unto itself, a science unto itself, and really difficult to understand. And I think Simon did a great job of laying a lot of that stuff out in the book. And then Jim, who had really taken the ball and run with it as far as getting himself up to speed, getting out there and becoming one of our top field consultants. And the important thing is that everybody had all this battle-scarred experience out there with customers, myself included, although my primary role is training IBM's internal engineers and support and development and QA people on Data Power. I maintain all the courseware for that. I do spend a lot of time out there with customers as well, and that's important to make sure that my internal training is really based on reality and the kind of battle scars you get out in the real world. So I think we put together a fantastic team and got really excited about the book. So a lot of what you see in this book is really based on things that happened to us out at customers, little snafus that we ran into. I don't like using the term best practices, but for lack of a better term and people being familiar with it, I would say that's really what we have there. But I didn't want to take the book and just break it down and say, okay, Simon, you're the network expert. Just write these chapters and we'll slap those in the book. The process we used was really a good process, I believe, because you know we did break the chapters apart and each person was responsible primarily for a chapter. But once the chapter was written, it went through 2 to 3 iterations of being passed through every single other author to add their insight on that particular topic and their experiences. So now you can see why it took us a year, right? This is a very long process, but in the end, I think we came up with the best book possible. So, you know, in the network chapters, not only do you see Simon's expertise in there, but everything the rest of us had to add based on what we had seen out in the field and what we had learned. A lot of tips and tricks and things like that. So, and in the end, it was pretty interesting because we contracted with the fine folks at Pearson who own the IBM Press label, as long as a lot of other well-known ones like Addison Wesley. The editing team worked with us throughout the whole process, and we had contracted for 700 pages. And, you know, by the end of this, we kept thinking of new things to add, and we wanted to cover as much detail as we could. But we got on a conference call at the end of the process pretty much with Pearson, and they were quite angry with us. You know, we were all proud that we came in at 960 pages and thought, oh boy, they're going to be so happy. Look what we did, all this great work. And they came on the call and were kind of upset that we had gone 260 pages over the contracted page limit. And we quickly learned a lesson in publishing because of production costs and things like that. They didn't want to have to reprice the book. And we had kind of a battle there because they wanted to slice some things out. But, you know, this book by then was our baby. All of us had put a lot of love and care into it. So we really stood our ground and refused or battled them anyway about cutting any content out of the book. And finally, they agreed. So I think the book, despite its heft and weight, is a great value. It's certainly usable as an exercise tool if you want to do push-ups with it or something. It's pretty useful. You don't need the big spongy ball. You can just use the book in your hotel rooms when you get bored. But that's pretty much the background and history of this whole book and how it came to pass. There's a lot more interesting stories than that I can't tell, you know, such as we decided we wanted to make the book very readable and kind of make it a friendly tone, use a lot of analogies and things. And Jim, being from New Jersey, came out the gate with the very first chapter. And let me just say, for a Jersey guy, some of his analogies I don't think we decided to use in the book, although it would have been a lot more interesting to a lot of folks out there and maybe marketable in some of the other areas of the bookstore. So, again, we all learned a big lesson on writing, although some of us had prior experience. But it was a lot of fun and a lot of stress. And I believe 100% in the product that we produced here. I think it's an invaluable resource. And I think that our Amazon ratings and the many comments we've gotten back attest to that. So well worth it. Okay, I think this is going to wrap up episode one of our podcast. I hope you all stay tuned for episode two, where we're going to cover some of the common use cases for the device, common usages that it was intended for. And I think you'll find a lot of that really interesting. So we'll talk to you when we get to episode two of the podcast. Thank you all for tuning in.